Welcome to The Buzz with ACT IAC, your source for the hot topics and top issues affecting the federal technology market. Join us each week to hear insights from government and industry experts, stay informed on the challenges facing the public sector, and gain access to valuable reports and thought leadership. Enjoy.
I will grab a seat myself. And so we're lucky today to have three great panelists, and I'm going to let them, we're going to start off by letting them all introduce themselves and just briefly tell us a little bit, kind of, there's two things, right? Where you sit determines how you see the world, and how you got there determines kind of how you feel about it, right? So we'll give each of them just a few minutes to tell us kind of where you sit and how you got there. Just a brief introduction. We'll get more into your organizations a little bit later. Tony?
Good morning, Tony Branham. I'm an associate CIO for at USDA with an office of the Chief Information Officer. I've been in my current position about year and a half. Prior to that, I was a CIO for rural development within the department. So I've been in USDA about almost 7 years, and prior to that, it's been about 9 years at energy, and then a few years in private industry, and then military before that.
Good morning, Rosie Bauer. I have actually grown up within the Army, so I've been there for about 20 years as an intern.
Grew up.
So I have spent most of my career right out of college within the Army. Right now, I am the deputy director within ASALT. Basically, we are responsible for arming and just making sure that our soldiers are ready for battle, whether it's weapons, whether just making sure they can execute the mission.
Good morning, everyone. Javier Inclán. I'm the Assistant Inspector General for Management and CIO at the National Science Foundation Office of Inspector General. I've been there for about a year and a half. Previously, I was at NSF proper in various functions, administrative services. I was the acting HR director. Fun fact, I was appointed the acting HR director on December 9, 2018. And for those of you that remember what happened, 11 days later, it was the beginning of a 35-day shutdown. So I had to sign 1,500 furlough notices. So that was fun. Before that, I started my federal career at the U.S. Army. I actually worked with Rosie many years ago at Fort Monmouth. I was at an agency called CERDEC. I was a BRAC officer. We moved down to Aberdeen Proving Ground. And I was there for 3 years. Then I went to USDA, Food Nutrition Service, DOT, and then NSF.
Well, so you Air Force people are definitely outgunned here. So I just we got you 3-2 so far.
But that's okay. We had F-35s. We'll make it all work.
Well, hey, we're going to start this panel with kind of, so we did a little research before we came up. And, you know, for those of us who've been around, we all kind of know that traditionally, historically, the government has always been able to recruit people kind of on the basis of a few things, right? It's always been about job stability, benefits. And a big part of it was always this perceived notion of self-fulfillment through a real mission, right? And that has, for decades, been how the government recruited and retained. It's why people came to work for the government. And to a certain extent, it still is. But as we now start to face the new generation coming into the workplace, they view things differently. They don't necessarily perceive stability as the same great thing it used to be. And there's been a lot of changes in the commercial world to help them catch up with the government in terms of some of the other workplace environment and mission issues, right? So I think, you know, as we go through this and we start looking at where we're at, I guess where we want to start is with that first one about mission, right? In what I call the age of digital disinformation, right? There's a lot of people out there saying a lot of things about the government, about the mission of the agencies. And so I want to kind of talk to this. Can you each give us your thoughts and ideas about what your agencies are doing to kind of advertise your mission and kind of promote with potential employees the facts that you are values-based organizations?
So I'll go first. So the Department of Agriculture, so diversity and inclusion is really a huge perspective for the department. One of the things that we've really pushed, also work-life balance. from the secretary on how to recruit, how do we put that value into the mission. USDA is very diverse, over 100,000 employees across 4,500 locations within the United States and abroad. And so we touch every part of the American public and overseas as we feed the world. And so because of that, we have to be very purposeful in how do we recruit, because it is very unique. We have very unique sectors. Some may be in agricultural marketing services where you're marketing like dairy products, like I Got Milk, or you're doing USDA Prime Beef, versus you're an inspection of the food supply coming in. Because we have this very diverse workforce, you're giving loans to rural America to build broadband or telecommunications. Each segment within the department has to really be purposeful in how do they do outreach, how do they reach out to the local community, whether it's through HBCUs, like historically black college and universities, or you're doing land grant universities, or you're reaching out to ag, like the Ag Connect within the local high schools. This is really how the department reaches out and starts building from the ground up. What is the mission and the value to start to recruit in? And then also talks about our value base from down, how are we looking at to include everyone as we're coming in and really promote diversity?
So within the Army, I will say, as I said previously, I've been there for 20 years. During my time, there's thousands of people in the Army. There has been over the past maybe 10 years, a huge shift on putting people first. Within the area that I work, obviously it's heavily STEM. So you're competing against a lot of very, very technical people within industry. So we've, over the years, have made a conscious effort to really start, you truly have to start young. So the Army has really been trying to recruit and involve at the high school level. Especially, there's been a big push, especially with girls, the women. There's, when you start getting into the engineering, IT, there's still a small amount of women, and it's really, they've been making a conscious effort to get involved at the high school levels, really start getting girls thinking about the STEM career within the Army. We've also been doing a lot of work-life balance. I think the pandemic, as the previous speaker, Ms. Gina, have said, has opened our eyes with the different tools and realized that if you're really going to recruit technical talent, they don't have to necessarily have been in the area. So we have made a conscious effort to promote remote work. We've hired a lot of people overseas. We have not been forcing people into work every day. We abide by the fact that you have to be in the office twice a pay period, so once every week, whatever the mission dictates. So we've really tried to be very flexible with our workforce. We've also been doing a lot of diversity. We target a lot of women in the different types of colleges, HBCUs. We do a lot of talks with at the different women conferences. So across within the past 10 years across the Army, we've really just tried to target a lot of diversity. And like I said before, we've really tried to make a conscious effort to start as early as in the high school levels.
Yeah, for us, it's maybe a little different only because we have an oversight mission, right? So while we work at the National Science Foundation, only a few of us, six of us, are actual scientists. The rest of them are auditors, criminal investigators, mission support specialists, et cetera. So I think the good government aspect of what we do is important, right? From our criminal investigators, not every 1811 wants to knock down doors every day. Right? So we're investigating grant fraud, which is certainly a good mission. Our auditors are looking at NSF, how they spend their money, not only from a who gotcha or, gotcha on this or gotcha on that, whether it's NSF or it's grantees or awardees, but also, hey, NSF, have you thought about doing things a little differently? And that could be a significant savings or, some type of improvement in their operation. And then the second thing is, I think it's the size of the office. We have, as of yesterday, 83 full-time employees, a very small entity, independent of NSF, although NSF's our parent agency. So there's that flexibility in HR, flexibility in other aspects of how we operate our office. For example, last July, 2022, we implemented our remote work and telework policy within the OIG, separate and distinct from NSF's, which is a little different, and they're actually starting October, I believe, to come back into the office 4 days of pay period. We're only requiring folks to come in 2 days of pay period if they're telework eligible. We do have a strong remote workforce. That did not start during the pandemic. That was in place 2019 and before. And there's a reason for that, right? Our stakeholders are across the country. So right now, out of our 83 employees, we are in 17 different states and in the District of Columbia. Very significant geographically dispersed workforce for a legitimate government and portable reason. And let me just talk about portability for a second. That's one thing that we emphasize. And I think the conversation of late, during, and after the pandemic, the word portability has gotten out of our vocabulary, which is really what telework and remote work is based on. What work is portable? What can you do that's outside of the office? And I think we need to bring that conversation back. So the ability to have, you know, good government work oversight, small agency, and the ability to have that real hybrid workforce because of our ability to differentiate from our parent agency.
So I'm going to abandon the script because I do a terrible job, clearly, when I try to read from the script. But can you guys hear me now? I was saying I was abandoning the script. But I want to come back to this idea of mission, right? So like Apple and this idea of advertising the mission. So Apple, and not just the mission, but the values based. And I think this is a bigger question than HR. Like Apple has this viral video out there, right? It is Apple, I think, with Octavia Spencer and playing Mother Nature. And, you know, talking about Apple's values in everything they're doing for sustainability and their, and, you know, so now everyone in America, I think, pretty much knows that within the next, whatever it is, 2 years, they're going to have every building in Apple is going to be carbon neutral, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not promoting Apple. I'm just trying to say, how do you guys as agencies, like, what do you think your agencies are doing? And do you think we're doing enough as a government in whole to kind of, I mean, that's what we're up against, right? We're literally, if you're trying to recruit an IT person to come work at USDA, you are recruiting against Apple. Apple has Octavia Spencer on the internet telling everyone that Apple is a values-based corporation. How do you, I guess the real question on the table is, to me, how does government, like, what does your agency do to get that word out? Because it's not enough to just go and put up a table, clearly, at land-grant college and hope people walk up and hear you talk about values, right?
So for us, our values are we need to bring our soldiers home, right? I mean, that's at the end of the day. Everything we do, our existence, everything we develop, every risk we take has to be our core focus is our soldiers. If we're not successful in what we're setting out to do, then they don't come home. I mean, that's the value from an Army perspective.
Yeah, I think for us, we just need to strengthen that recruitment population and expand that applicant pool. And we do that by stressing the importance of government. Yes, Apple is going to take away a lot of our folks. But I'll give you an example within the government. We had somebody who graduated from the Scholarship for Service program. So basically paid, you know, had his master's degree paid for. We recruited him. Another intelligence agency recruited him. Really cool intelligence agency that, you know, I told him, are you sure you want to come work for us? Because that's pretty cool. His difference was he had to move to Maryland. He lived in Missouri, wanted to move to Texas with his girlfriend, and made the decision to come work for us, right? So that was the difference. There is a data point right there that reminds us that the remote work affordability really is important for some of these folks, especially those that are coming out of school. The other thing is, you know, we need to figure out what that population is and not compete with the Apples. The NSF OIG is not going to compete with Apple, right? We're just not. But what is it? You know, what is that recruitment? You know, was your parent, one of your parents a Fed? Is your friend a Fed? Have we done a good job recruiting at the schools? You know, things like that. And I'm a big proponent of Uncle Sam in general, right? So if they don't want to work for me, do they want to work with Rosie? Do they want to work with Tony? Right? You know, get them into the government. Once they're in that family, then we could figure out, you know, who's going to poach who, you know, what day, who's going to develop the folks. So I think it's, you know, are you going to be attracted to the government work? And if you do, then that's when we have to, you know, hit the gas and make sure that we're recruiting the best and the brightest.
So one of the few things that we're doing, so we're really doing a lot of outreach to tech the gov, especially in the IT space. So within the last year, with all the layoffs across in the news, one of the things we've purposely done is tech the gov, how do we get seasoned IT professionals into the government? We've actually been pretty successful and able to do that and start to convert people back into the government. But this is really about value-based. What is the mission? How do they connect? And a lot of times, when we're interviewing, we'll say, why are you interested in coming to the government? This is, I really love the mission. You know, we want to do good. This is why we come to the public sector. Also, it's the same thing with what we tell for our own staff. And one of the things I struggle as a leader as I'm talking to my staff is like, why do you work for the department? Why does it make a difference to the public? If you don't understand it yourself and you can't communicate it as a hiring manager, then we're at a disadvantage. Because that time during the interview is when we sell to the applicants. And this is what I tell them. I said, this is why we're doing it. This is why it's important. The more we reiterate this all from the top down so that all levels of our supervisors and managers understand it, even our employees, this is how we do from the top down, bottom up. Because a lot of times my employees are doing the referrals in, or the recruiting force. So that way I don't have to do it. And they actually help us. And more we do this broad base, I think this is part of the value. One, start within your own organization so they understand the value, why it's important, and reiterate why we're doing what we're doing.
Fantastic. So I'm gonna shift gears. Some of you touched on diversity a little bit when you were kind of making your opening comments, but I wanna come back to it just for a sec, because one of the big things about Gen Z, one is this idea of a values-based employer. The second thing is just reading a survey recently, I think it's something like 80-something percent of Gen Z workers coming into the workforce feel very strongly about inclusivity and diversity in the workforce. And of course, the federal government, I track these numbers on a regular basis, right? And we have made, shall we say, very marginal progress on diversity over the past 20 years. And I mean, very marginal, right? Members of all minority groups and women are all underrepresented by, at least 20-30% at every level of leadership across the entire government, with some agencies much worse than others. The thing about Gen Z is the first generation we've had in this country where more than 50% of the Gen Z workforce coming up do not identify as white. And 20% do not identify as cis heterosexual people. So this idea it shouldn't really surprise anyone when we do a survey and like 80+% of them think that DE&I is important, right? Like all these companies like Goldman Sachs and the Koch brothers didn't all wake up and decide they were going to have DEI&A initiatives at their companies because they believe in unicorns and want to make the world a better place, right? They do it because they know they need to make more money, right? And so one of the things that hamstrings us in the government is we're still using resumes to hire people, right? Like you can't get any more racist or sexist than that. We're still using, past employment salaries to set your starting salary, right? It's the most sexist thing in the world. It's illegal in like most of the states now, right? So, I guess the question is, what are you guys doing, if anything, what are your organizations doing to try to replace some of those antiquated systems? This is an IT group, right? How are we getting rid of the antiquated systems that force us to rely on these incredibly bad? I don't know. I know you're not supposed to use terms like bad, but there's no way to make using resumes to screen 90% of your employees good, right? So, what are you trying to do to get past some of that stuff?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So number one is we established a DEIA council within the OIG when I started back in May of 2022. Just yesterday, Dr. Christina McGuire, who's our personnel psychologist within the OIG, who's in the room today, submitted the draft to me. So I have to review that. Christina, I'll get that to you next couple of days. So that's one thing. Very important to the IG, having that diversity and inclusion piece. The second thing is I will say is that, and I took this upon myself, there is no tech solution, at least that I don't know. If anybody has one, please call me or talk to me afterwards. We recently recruited for an assistant IG for audits. We opened up that position. remotely, because a lot of the folks in audits work across the country, and we want to make sure that we're providing an opportunity not only for our own staff that work outside of the DC area, but also to expand, you know, the population to really the best and the brightest. You know, some of us think that because we live in the DC area, we're the only or the best and the brightest, and that's not necessarily the case. So when I saw the list and the IG put me in charge of the recruitment process, I talked to HR at NSF, who handles our HR stuff, and I said, hey, I'd like to do blind resume review for the rating and ranking. They thought I was absolutely out of my mind. I said, look, there's a handful. There's 33, I think, applications. I will do it myself. So they had an internal meeting. They talked about it, and they said, okay, you know, we'll let you do that. So what I did was I took out names, I took out schools, and I took out addresses. Right, and I figured those were the three things that are relatively easy to identify, but also very significant when it comes to potential unconscious, and let me be bold enough to say, maybe conscious bias, right? So if your name's Javier, maybe you don't wanna hire Javier, and there's a bias there, either conscious or unconscious. So I did that. I took out all of the names, all the addresses, all the schools. There were a couple of quotes that they put in there that said, that identified their gender. I took that out as well. All right, so I took my time. It took a while. I'm not going to say it took an hour. It took much more than that. But I thought that it was really worth it for two reasons. Number one, it's worth it. Number two, it was worth it because it was at least a step in the right direction and to demonstrate that this may work. So I sent this to the rating and ranking panel. They were ecstatic. There were three external assistant IGs from across the IG community. They were amazed that we had been able to do that. They went through their process. They submitted six names for the interviews. We conducted interviews. We broke that blind resume because they were face-to-face virtually. But, you know, I believe we ended up hiring the best candidate overall, regardless of demographic, regardless of whatever, right? Because we didn't know who we were going to get. Now, I know what those folks were, those 33. And if I had to take a guess of, you know, what race they were, what gender, you know, I could probably do that at least, you know, 70, 75% of the time. But I wanted to eliminate that piece of it. And I think that's the important part. The third thing I want to say is that we talk a lot about recruiting a diverse population. And I'm very concerned about that because there's always a check the box mentality when it comes to that. Oh, I hired two African Americans, three Hispanics, one Asian American, one person with disabilities, somebody from the LGBTQI plus, I'm good. But then we lost them after a year because we're not being inclusive. We're not providing that belonging sense. Right, so what do we do? It's a zero-sum game, right? So if we're just checking the box and hiring folks just because, we're really just back to where we started. So I think there's the entire package. I think it's Johnny Taylor, the head of SHRM, that said he would put the I in front of the DE&A, and I agree 100%. I would make it, you know, inclusion first and then the rest, because I think once you have inclusion, the rest of it follows.
That's fantastic. Rosie, Tony?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, it's similar situation as Javier. I would say we have a long way to go, to be quite honest. But I do think that within the Army, we have also been standing up a lot of diverse and inclusion type of councils and panel members and things like that, too. Because I think the first thing that we've recognized what we have to do is educate. There's people that have been there for years, right? So there is a climate change, there's an education side of all this that I think is critical. We've piloted something similar where we've had resumes where we've completely deleted or removed the age, the salaries, the names, and just basically looked at the skill sets. You know, are you hiring the right person or the right skill sets for the job that you need? I would say that's not something that's been adopted quite yet across, but that is something that as a department we are looking and then trying to figure out how do we educate and then how do we adopt that sense of mentality. I do agree there. I think sometimes we do get into the check the box. I will say for myself, right, as a minority, one of the biggest things is you have to look at the leadership. So if I'm walking inside a building, I look at the picture. What do I see? I don't see myself. So I think mentorship within the department is also critical, right? We want to recruit, but then how do we get the folks that are also there that are diverse? How do we get them also in the leadership position? So I think it's both, and it's like Javier said, it's the full, it's everything.
So I mean, think there's a lot of partnership with HR to help a lot of us, and how do we start to get past the resumes. I mean, one of the things we're doing just within my own organization, and I know my staff complaining about it, because when we get candidates through like USA Jobs, they have to take some sort of assessment. You know, it takes an hour or two. There's more skills based, or are they the right candidates before it even gets to the resume, before our hiring managers even see that, and even the HR specialist. So that's one of the things that we're doing. Does it really address some of the diversity we're looking for? Probably not, but it's one of the, at least from a straight skills perspective, it's more neutral in terms of, because it's based upon whether you're an HR specialist or an IT specialist or that career field. So at least from that perspective, it starts to make it more, you know, objective. Is it perfect? No. But, you know, one of the other things that we do, I mean, like, I had the largest part of IT federal staff within the department. Of that, I have 46% that's vet. And so we actually do many different sectors. Obviously, vets is a huge sector for us in terms of what we hire, veterans. In addition, you know, one of the things we're really looking at is bringing in younger candidates into the program. But I can tell you from my experience recruiting across the United States, a lot of places I don't have diversity. I can tell you my hiring managers will get a cert and there's no diversity on the cert. I can hire in North Dakota, South Dakota. I just don't have diversity there. And so there are certain segments that we just don't have. And I think in the first keynote speaker, they were talking about leadership. You know, how do we groom, and maybe it's your question, how do we groom the next set of leaders? Well, the problem in some of our industry is that I don't have that workforce coming up into the pipeline, even to begin with. So until it becomes more diverse coming into our industry, into certain sectors, whether it's HR or IT or whatever it is, I'm not going to be able to recruit that and mentor it all the way up. So I think we're missing from the beginning. And so we have to really, really look at, you know, you talked about 50% is, you know, more diverse today. Well, until that actually makes it up into our, you know, mid-career, this is where we're going to start to see the difference. I think it has to start at that point, not now. I think we're kind of, we have to wait for it to catch up to us.
All right. I am going to shift gears a little bit from values and morals and ethics to it turns out that survey says Gen Z still likes money. So I, you know, there's a Monster survey out there done, I'm pretty sure it was Monster, did the survey recently. And one of the things that makes Gen Z different than traditional government employees is the second highest reason they use for switching jobs is to go to a job with a more obvious career ladder, a stepping stone, if you will. And so that's kind of very different than our old, you know, you have to have 8 people work for you to be a GS-15, you have to have 8 people, and then you have to have so many GS-15s working for you to be an SES. And, you know, we wait and go through our years and our ladders. And, you know, it's just clear from the data that, you know, they're not planning to stay. They didn't come into this job planning to stay here 5 years. It's not their model, right? They're looking at your job saying, well, where am I going to be 24 to 36 months from now? What is my next job, right? And so I guess this kind of goes with your inclusivity discussion, but it's regardless of what someone looks like or where they come from, how do you deal with the fact that you got old farts like me that just won't give up their SES billets, right? And so it kind of backs up the whole thing, kind of like the Fort Lee Tunnel, right? The bridge. And so how are you addressing that within your organizations? How are you kind of helping people? Because this one drives me crazy, because it should be someplace the government would be great, except that our systems make it very hard to go from being a GS-13 at agency X to a GS-14 at agency Y. Even if you're like going from commerce from one bureau to another, you might as well be applying from, you know, California, right? There's no benefit to being in-house, right? So how are you guys dealing with some of those issues to make those opportunities more obvious?
So this is a big issue, even within IT, within USDA. And one of the things, we just were recently at a CIO council offsite, and we were talking about some of these challenges. And one of the challenges is, you know, one, government is not naturally set up where I can move people along like in private industry. I just don't have that career growth that's naturally built in. But there's certain things that we can do. You know, we can figure out how to do rotational assignments within our own department to, one, make jobs interesting and give people a career growth. Because the one of the worst things to do is have a high potential person stuck into a slot you're not taking advantage of. You know, you're not nurturing their career to give them opportunities to grow and expand. And so one of the things we've been talking about within the department is, one, you know, at the senior level, we're doing rotations. So we started a program where we started rotating 14s and 15s to give them opportunities within different missioners within the department. But we also want to push this down to our mid and lower career where we start to rotate and give them opportunity if they want to go experience something like go to a missionary like rural development or marketing and regulatory programs or food and nutrition services, then come back to the department level and you get to see, one, the mission side, but then also the departmental side. So you get to see the different aspects of it. In addition, you get to, you know, you'll get, you know, exposure to different technologies and missions that, you know, those missionaries may be doing. For example, like food and nutrition, like the SNAP program may be doing, you know, category management, purchasing, and how do they do that type of systems versus loan programs and like rural development. So one, how do we mentor that? But then how do we actually build that into our ecosystem so that it's available to everyone? And so that we actually do those rotations and detailed assignments and make it beneficial, then actually do a career growth. One of the new things we're doing is like IT product managers. So this is a huge need within the federal government. How do we get IT product managers that are not just technical, but also know the business side? So this is something that we're really partnering on within the department to start to nurture these and hire them into each of the mission areas so we can bridge the gap between one IT, but then on the business side.
That's fantastic. Rosie?
So we have something similar. I think we've stood up different rotation programs for within the Army where we can have folks, they join the government, it's like a 3-year program and they rotate to different areas just to give them different perspectives, give them different, you know, the different projects that are going on, the different missions. But we've also started partnering with a lot of industry to give them rotation opportunities, even with industry. I will tell you, we have a similar challenge. We have a very big challenge, right? And we're very STEM. That's where we are. So in the STEM area, you know, we offer to pay for your master's degree, we offer to pay for, so it's not just all necessarily salary, but we also offer to pay for your education. With all that, we're still facing challenges when you have, you know, the kids that are coming out of college that we're trying to recruit, for example, software developers. You know, we are limited to how much we can pay them, right? And where we are up against industry that's paying them close to $200,000. I mean, we're just not going to compete with that. So, you know, the different things that we are doing are, like I said, paying for education, give them the flexibility to move around, but then also giving them the flexibility of remote work. You don't necessarily have to be here. You can, you know, if you're on the other side of the country, we've had people right now that are in different parts of the world, right? So offering those types of flexibilities, especially in areas like software development, you know, those types of work where you don't necessarily have to be in the office. You can develop software, you can do that type of thing, you know, all over the world. So I think with those flexibilities as well as the moving around, we've been able to be a little bit more successful than we've previously been.
Yeah, so for us, we have a challenge and a opportunity, which is the same, which is the size of our office. We don't have that size to be able to rotate folks around, provide them different experiences, but the Council of Inspectors General does have a fellow program that we participate in, and you go from one IG to another, and you learn, you know, what a different function is, you know, what a different agency does with respect to the oversight that they conduct. But the good thing about being small is that we could focus on job series. We don't have a lot of diversity when it comes to a job series, and we'll focus on auditors, which is more than a third of our population. So what the retired assistant IG for audits told me was, I don't hire auditors, he said. He said, I hire people that could think, that could write, that could communicate. And then I teach them how to audit, right? So what we've done is we've actually announced positions at a 7-9 career ladder, 301 job series, more generic, get them into the position, and then open up, which it actually just closed about 3 weeks ago, an 11, 12, 13 career ladder for an auditor for a 5-11. And we give them the opportunity to compete. And we tell them during the interview process up front that they will have an opportunity to compete. You can't pre-select, you can't guarantee them anything, you can't promise them anything. But we give them that opportunity so that they could see something. Hey, if I do well, if I learn this job, if I become a junior auditor, I could then have an opportunity to compete, you know, 5-11, 12, 13. So imagine the GS-7, 5-6 years from now, you're gonna be a GS-13 if everything goes well. So those are the things that we're trying to promote from a small agency perspective.
All right. Well, that's all pretty cool. And I'm also trying to be conscious of time so we can let folks ask questions, because I think that's always kind of a big part. Maybe before I ask the next question, I'll ask the crowd for questions. You guys okay with that?
Sure.
And because we only have about 15 minutes left, so I want to be very sensitive to that. And anyone out there in the crowd have questions? Yes, sir. Back there. Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Pearl LaRue. So, question on a lot of good information, by the way. Thank you so much. When you look for your candidates, where do you look? Because on the other side of the house, the process to submit candidates, when you look at the requirements, you want someone with Python, ChatGPT, wears a pink shirt every Thursday. Even though you meet, you know, every single requirement, they don't get chosen, and then there's no feedback. I know it's not practical. Okay, you have 500 resumes. You can't give, you know, every agency feedback as to why your candidate wasn't chosen. But what would be your advice on, you know, how do we better package the candidate so that they're taken a look at?
So this is a challenge, I think, in our hiring process. This goes back to the resume base, especially when we go through USA Jobs or something like that, because typically speaking, unless I do an SME panel where we get to review everything, the hiring manager only gets a subset from HR. And this has always been a challenge, especially in the STEM areas, where a lot of times, unless it's an HR specialist that understands your segment, you may get resumes that don't really meet your needs. And so I think this is a challenge. One of the things we've done more is more like career fair days, where like we've gone out to like Bowie State, and we're partnering with Forest Service on stuff, or like with Wounded Warriors, where we're actually doing those sort of recruitments, or we're getting resumes directly. That's probably a better mechanism for us at this point than doing traditional, just going through applying online. So this is part of the things that we're looking at, is how do we continue to evolve. The other thing that we found is through the Tech2Gov is a lot of our candidates that we've gotten, they've actually worked through our point of contact with the government to tell us we're interested in applying. So we know to look for their resumes, and we'll actually do a different, depending upon the type of job, we may actually ask for all the resumes in so we can have a tech panel actually review them. So it's a better process than just using the normal, you know, having HR do it. So it's not perfect. It's one of those challenges we have in government, just because it has to be, we have to follow certain rules and regulations and how we do it. And so, for example, like veterans, if we go full and open, you know, a lot of the veterans will go to the top of the, depending upon where we're getting the government, they may be on the resumes we get to start with. And some of it's policy based upon where you're at in your HR department.
Yeah, so we have similar challenges. One of the things, so we go through USA Job, and it's similar. It's similar challenge there, where we have an HR person that filters the resumes, and what we get back is a subset. So one of the things that I think has helped us is recruiting, physically going to a lot of these fairs, but having the flexibility that we can hire on the spot. Obviously, there's background checks and all that has to happen, but that has helped us a lot, because we can talk to you, we can understand what your skill sets are, we can better understand, you know, that one-on-one conversation that occurs at these recruits has really helped us hone in on the skill sets that we need and the right person to fill those skill sets. And the fact that we have the flexibility to hire you right there has been very, very successful for us.
Rosie, can I ask you a question about that? I'm sorry, but like, so I remember I, for the show, I've interviewed a few folks from DHS, right? And DHS is really big on this, go to the conference and do the tentative offer on the spot. How do people know about these events? Like, how are you guys advertising these events? Like, how would Bob on Main Street, Wichita, know that there was going to be an event for recruiting somewhere?
Yeah, so communication is always a challenge. So I mean, we do advertisement for the job fairs. I mean, we try to be as, you know, we try to get ourselves to these job fairs, right? I think that in itself is the challenge, making sure that we have the right person to attend. But I think the Army has done where they'll post things online, LinkedIn. We're finally in the new age now, right? So I think we have a better posture on many social platforms. So, I mean, it is a challenge. We're trying to take advantage as much as the social media as possible. But the big thing is making sure that the hiring officials, the people that are doing the actual hiring, physically getting them there.
So to answer, and I'm sorry, I just want to keep going with this because I know this is like a thing now, right? Like, so for the person out there who just asked about how to package themselves up, is following like ASALT social media or following, you know, USDA or is that now like, cause I mean, that's something we tell in the commercial world. That's what people do, right? They know to do that for companies they want to work at. Is that really, do you guys, the three of you think that's something that would help someone who's trying to get in, is to pick the agency they want to go to and start tracking their social media and looking for these things? Or
I think that would be one of the legs on the stool, right? I don't think it's the end all be all, but it's certainly helpful. Some folks are very, you know, direct. I want to work for state, DHS, whatever. You know, some people say I'm more of a STEM person. I want to work for NSF, Army, USDA, et cetera, right? But you shouldn't be limiting yourself to that, but it's certainly one way of getting deeper into that recruitment process.
We got another question, I think. Justin?
So, and I apologize for the length of this question, but so we see studies that say that that being able to make decisions for yourself is really a motivator, that, you know, executives tend to have less stress actually because they make more decisions versus those that don't. And so in an organization like the federal government where there's so much hierarchy, how do you get that authorities push down so people can make decisions and feel like a part of that? And sort of a corollary to that is, how do you get diversity of thought if you're hiring folks down at that level and get the real diversity, but one person's making all the decisions at the top?
Yeah, I will just say I'm dying for Rosie to answer this, because I think the Army is better at this than any federal civilian agency I've ever seen. But go ahead. You want to go first, Javier? Yeah, you go, man. No.
So the Army has done a lot of empowering down. And I will say the folks that we are recruiting, we want them, one of the biggest criteria that we have been very vocal is the ability to critically think. We have been given people, we want people to be innovative, and we've been very vocal on that. We, you know, especially when you go out, when you're competing against the Apples of the world, they're, you know, they are recruiting people that are creative, that are innovative, and are risk takers. And I think that is a huge evolution in the Army that I have personally seen, where the leaders, nobody's going to make a decision from my perspective that I have seen in a vacuum. They're just not. We want those folks that have different ways of doing things. And we've empowered all the way down to the GS7. We've brought them in and we have said, what are your thoughts on these projects? You know, don't be afraid to take a risk. Don't be afraid to be innovative, especially in the STEM area. If we're gonna evolve and continue to keep up with technology, that ability to be innovative is extremely, extremely critical for us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, communication and expectations, from a personal perspective, I don't want to make every decision. That's a lot of pressure, right? And I don't do the job that other folks do within my organization. They do the job, right? I'll give you an example. When I was at the Marshals Service, I had a call from the chief financial officer, and she said they wanted to change something with a fleet card, travel card, something, I forget what it was, some type of purchase card that would impact my office. So I called the folks, you know, the administrative folks, the financial folks in my office, and I said, hey, this is what's being proposed. What do you think? And there was complete silence on the other side. And it was middle of pandemic, so everybody's virtual. And it was like 30 seconds of very awkward silence. So I said, okay, let me ask the question again. What do you think? And then finally, the 14 said, you know, sir, because Marshal Service is very hierarchical, you know, sir, we're not saying anything because this is the first time we've ever been asked our opinion that affected us. And that just like took the air out of me, right? And I was like, wait, hold on a second. Are you saying that this? And she's like, yeah, we just get decisions and we execute. And then we had the conversation for about 20 minutes about why it was not a great idea, and they gave me a course of action to change. So I went back to the CFO, presented that, and she said, wow, what a great idea. Didn't think about it that way. That's the way we're going to go. Right? So that's just a very simple example of, you know, you have to empower folks. They need to be part of the organization. The FEBS always talks about, you know, how do you feel connected to the mission or not? And when you're in support services or mission support, it's more difficult, right, to see yourself as a NASA janitor, right? But I think those are the things like, man, I just made a recommendation, a course of action, or a decision that impacted the way our folks do our job, and it's for the better because we know what we're doing. And it sounds simple, but it's not very common, unfortunately.
So for like my organization, more about culture. And so when I came to my specific organization I am now, I had to push down really, how do I change the culture from the, you know, all the lowest level supervisor all the way up and empower them? And I used to get a lot of questions. I said, well, what do you think? How are we going to do this? And so we started spinning up work groups to really make the decision at the lowest level and come up with the solutions. And actually, we celebrate it. One of the things I tell them, some of the best solutions we've come up with has actually come from you. It didn't come from me. You know, I just said, this is where we want to go, but you tell us how we're going to do it. You guys figure out the technical details, because I don't have that anymore. I said, you guys really have to enable it, figure out where we want to go, and lead us to the vision. The more you enable it, this, the more you trust them, I think is important. But the other thing is, I always tell them is, it's okay to make mistakes. And a lot of things as leaders, we, you know, we say go do it, but then, you know, it's a risk reward, but it should always be a reward, because I want them to go out there and take that risk. And this is the culture shift that we've done, is how do we enable them to be able to do that? But also, how do we invest and give them the tools to do it, which is important. And so I think that it's just not about giving them the ability to make decisions, but also train them and give them the tools and mentor them to be able to do it.
All right, so I would love to ask one more question from the crowd, but it's 9:36, so I'm supposed to wrap up at 9:40. I'm looking in the back of the room to say, they're telling me one more question? All right, we got time for one more question.
As you guys know, the Chance to Compete Act is winding its way through the Hill, which is really a different lens around using skills for deciding, rather than resumes, it's about skills. My question to you is if that comes in place, obviously what you're trying to do is what you want to do, but how agile are you if you had to do it? So if Congress said, hey, we're going to go to skills-based hiring, how agile are you guys around making that happen for your agencies?
Very. Again, the size of our office, right? We pretty much control our own destiny. Although we use NSF as our service provider for HR, we provide them the basis of how we want to hire within, you know, Title V, et cetera. So, you know, we're very much committed to this skills-based type of approach, because again, going back to what the previous AIGA said, I don't need to hire an auditor. I need to hire somebody that could think, that has a certain skill set, right? And depending on what that is, sure, criminal investigator needs to go through basic training, they need to go to FLETC, et cetera. But besides that, you know, there are certain things that we don't need. I'm a history major, leave it at that, right? So at the end of the day, did I use my history degree? Maybe, because I had a piece of paper and somebody said, you need a piece of paper in order to move on to the next round, right? So maybe that's what it got. Let's eliminate that when we don't need to, right? If I don't need to have an accounting degree or a legal degree or a medical degree or whatever the case may be, let's go more to what can you do for me today, hit the ground running, and what could I do to train you, right? What have you demonstrated in your career, educational or experiential? Is that a word? You know, to be able to have a that good fit for our organization, whether it's a GS5 or a GS15.
So I would say for the size of our organization, we are very, very flexible. I mean, we are, for us to in the area of STEM, for us to compete and continue to stay at the you know, keep up with the speed of technology, we need to make sure we have the right people. I mean, the right skill sets. And that critical thinking, that innovation, that's really what we need right now. So we are extremely critical. If today we were told we can hire based on skills, we would be ready to go. Absolutely.
And the same thing for us. I mean, we're really looking at the digital workforce as we go forward and how it's evolving. And what do we actually need for the future? And we actually need to get away from the resume base, like make it more skills based for where we're going. So we're ready to go. It's just, you know, how do we get there quick enough to meet our needs? And then how do we compete with private industry is going to be the bigger. Actually, within government, sometimes it's a challenge. Someone talked about the special pay rate. That's actually difficult for some of the agencies that don't have that. So I'm actually competing against VA in some instances.
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, I'm trying to say this is a vendor neutral environment, of course, but I would say that there are at least two or three FedRAMP authorized vendors I know of, at least two of which I think are members of ACT IACT, who have skills-based hiring platforms that all four of the military services already use. I guess I left off the Coast Guard, but four of the five military services use. But anyway, I would say so we're wrapping up here with kind of in terms of Gen Z and this new employer employee compact for Gen Z. I think we're wrapping up with this idea that we know first and foremost these people aren't planning to stick around for 20 years. Their number one thing is they need to be able to see where their next promotion is going to be. They need that clear career ladder. And we get some ideas on how different agencies are providing that clear career ladder and opportunity roadmap. I think the next thing is they want a values-based organization. And we know that, you know, both sides of the political spectrum are beating the crap out of the federal government at one point or another, right? And overall, the faith in the federal government has gone down like dramatically ever since World War II and consistently. So we know there's this challenge we need to overcome individually and collectively as agencies to kind of promote the fact that we're values-based employers. I guess the third part is we know the data also show us that this is the most diverse generation that's ever entered the workforce. And if we don't have inclusivity and we don't have diversity in our workforce and we can't demonstrate that to potential employees, not just by talking about it, but actually having the systems and the processes in place that support it, we just won't be able to compete, right? And I think we had some great examples here from all three organizations about how to kind of lay out this career ladder, make the organization more diverse and inclusive, as a way to increase quality, not just as a check the block numbers game. But I think it's been a pretty good panel. I think, you know, if you each want 30 seconds to just give a one last closing comment.
Yeah, to the point about Gen Z and any applicant pool, I think the term that comes to mind is transparency, right? So the interview process is bilateral, and we know we want to recruit that applicant, but we need to be fair to them and ask them what they want. Right? We can't do a bait and switch. And I think we do a terrible job across the federal government of training hiring managers and interview panelists of how to interact with applicants, right? You may see the perfect candidate on paper. You want them so bad, you're going to be blinded by whatever you hear on the other side, right? And you're doing them a disservice, right? Because you're maybe making them take a job that a year from now they're going to leave, not because of anything that they could have controlled, but because you didn't provide them that opportunity to ask the questions of what the job really entails and what the expectations are.
So I do want to thank you for inviting me here. I really enjoyed it. The big thing that I think, and I keep emphasizing, is I agree, transparency. I think it's extremely critical for us to hone, you know, really hammer away the importance of the mission, but then also help them grow, right? I mean, help them be innovative, help them be risk takers. I think that mentorship and, you know, is really going to be important and continues to be important. You know, these guys, they want to be successful in their careers, just like we wanted to be successful in ours. So really offering them the flexibility to grow, whether it's with us, whether it's with another agency, it doesn't matter. As long as, it's like Javier said, as long as we understand where they want to be, we understand, and we help them get there. I think mentorship is going to be continues to be a big thing.
So one, thank you for inviting me to the Beyond the Panel. It's very good. So I think one of the big things to remember is, from my perspective, is we're going to continue to be multi-generational workforce for a while. So how do I continue to converge and make it one workforce so we meet all the needs and actually see the uniqueness that we have? But then also the work-life balance, I think, is important, especially for all generations. It's just not one generation now. They're all looking at work-life balance. How do we leaders continue to, one, meet our mission, but then allow the work-life balance? So how many people can be remote? How many people can be telework, you know, however many days per week? And then do that, give them, you know, geographic location specific that may meet their needs, but then at the same time allows us to accomplish our mission for the department or where our organization is. The other thing is mobility. I think hopefully within government at some point will make it easier to be mobile within departments and the hiring structure to do details and stuff, so we can keep, you know, those high performers and keep them moving in their careers. I think that's the, if it was up to me, that'd be the biggest change we could do within government. How do I give them the natural career progression without having them to apply for a new job every time they want to move?
And with that, I'd like to thank, please help me in thanking all three of our panelists for giving us their insights today.
And that's a wrap on The Buzz with ACT IAC. Join us next week for more hot topics and top issues affecting the federal technology market. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on Twitter at ACT IAC. More information about today's show can be found in the episode notes. For more insights, visit www.actiac.org. Thanks for listening.